Hello, I'm Lina Ahmoudou. Welcome to Health Chat. On the program today, we will discuss nutrition and climate change. Our expert is Sean Baker, Chief Program Officer at Helen Keller International. But first, Zambia's Ministry of Education says it has delayed the start of the academic year for students due to a widespread cholera outbreak. Both primary and secondary students initially set to resume school at the beginning of January will resume classes on January 29th. The outbreak, driven by inadequate sanitation infrastructure, according to reports, in some part of the country has spurred concerns about the nation's health security. Since October, Zambia's Ministry of Health has reported over 5,000 confirmed cases and nearly 200 fatalities in five of the country's 10 provinces. The country has mobilized efforts to clean learning institutions, install hand-washing facilities, and distribute disinfectants in all educational settings. Nearby countries like South Africa and Zimbabwe have also faced cholera outbreaks in recent months. The government has been in talks with the WHO to acquire a cholera vaccine by the end of this month. However, experts anticipate that the outbreak will be worsened by heavy rains. Now, community health focuses on people and their role as determinants of their own health as well as the health of others. The WHO says community health is defined as environmental, social, and economic resources to sustain emotional and physical well-being among people in ways that advance their aspirations and satisfy their needs in their unique environment. In Ethiopia, infectious disease specialist Dr. Tigist Girma returned to her country after 42 years of service abroad. Dr. Tigist opened Le DEG Midwifery College to offer free midwifery education for girls who come from the rural parts of Ethiopia so they can be change makers in the health of their communities. VOA's Kennedy Abate has the details.
Dr. Tigist Girma founded Le DEG Midwifery College in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, 5 years ago. The college provides free degree programs for girls and women who came from places with few prenatal and maternal care workers. Dr. Tigist says her own mother experienced medical problem during her birth, but she survived. This has been her motivation.
I know the reason I survived is because I was born in Addis Ababa and that my parents had money to take me to the hospital. On that same day, many people from rural part of the country died because they don't have money to come to the city and access to medical assistance. And still now, many are dying from childbirth.
The college is currently providing degree-level programs to the second batch of 115 students. Dr. Tigist explained that the students will be monitored after they finish their studies and start working.
What we provide is not limited to formal education. We also teach them how to be confident and a leader. We teach them to educate other women in their community.
Fatuma Abdu came from the northeastern part of the country's Afar region.
The opportunity itself is great, and I liked the education too. Once I finish this education, I want to serve the uneducated Afar community, which provided me the opportunity of education.
Shigetsu Asimamawu, a student who comes from South Omo zone of the southern region, says while studying, she has also gained experience and knowledge about the strength and perseverance of women.
In my region, or the village I come from, I did not know that women could do this. I used to think women always needed to depend on men. But now I learned that women can plan and achieve what they put their mind to.
The philanthropist, Dr. Tigist, is currently running the college with personal finance and support from friends and donors. She recently opened a maternal and child medical center in the same building. The aim of the hospital is to keep the college independent and provide service to the community at a low cost.
Mm-hmm. For more insight on community engagement, we spoke with Asha Hassan, a community health promoter in Nairobi who works with people in Nairobi's informal settlement of Kibera.
First, I can say that the best way you can handle your community is the rapport you have created with them, how you handle them, how you talk to them, the way you respect each other, and more so the confidentiality. Yeah, because you can see that there's many households that have defaulters in TB, HIV defaulters, and other chronic diseases. Now, if you are not able to keep the secrets of the clients or that person of that household, they will not be able to give you the information you want. These community members know that we work with different organizations, and they also believe that some organizations help a lot. So when they know that you have, you can extend your hand and give them a helping hand more than the family, they can be able to tell you everything and every information you want, so that they can get that assistance from other organizations. Yeah, though it's a bit challenging, but if you create a good rapport, you can get the information. And if, like CHPs, we have the organization that helps people with HIV and TB patients. They give them food, they make sure they have medicines, but they must be fluent in taking the medicines. Yeah, so when the client knows that she or he can get that assistance, they can be able to give you the information you want. Culture have come to make work hard for us, because many people believe in their cultures. There are some who believe that going to hospital, you are going to die. You will not come back home alive. Some believe that when you are going to hospital, maybe you will be admitted and maybe don't have that money. Some believe that it's better to stay at home and drink the medicine from these Maasai people. Yeah, so it's hard to deal with people who believe in their culture, really hard. Even the children under 5, the children don't get the immunization that they're supposed to get. And even if you force them, they won't take the children for immunization. It makes me feel bad, because if I see the children who suffer from polio, and then you see a parent from such culture don't want the children to go and get immunized, I feel very bad, because maybe this child, when he or she grows up, she will grow with the complications. Yeah, it makes me feel so bad and feel like the baby has not received enough from the parents and the community at large.
The International Livestock and Research Institute and Kenya Medical Research Institute have partnered with Zoonotic Disease Unit to study how climate change affects the population and species of mosquitoes and disease transmission pattern by vectors. The International Livestock and Research Institute has set up weather stations in different locations in the country to monitor weather patterns. Willis Akwale is a senior advisor for Kenya Malaria Council, and James Akoko, research scientist at International Livestock Research Institute. They explain.
With increasing temperature, with increasing amount of rainfall and humidity, there is more breeding. There are more breeding sites, and there is therefore a high chance of transmission of vector-borne diseases like malaria, like dengue, like Rift Valley fever and chikungunya. And with this, therefore, you are likely to see increased cases of these diseases. And in an area like northern Kenya that is not very well developed in terms of health infrastructure, there will be a strain on the health system.
The reason why we've set up a weather station in this area to be able to capture the different environmental conditions like temperature, like humidity, like wind speed and wind direction, to be able to really relate how these different components of climate could be influencing the population of vectors, and could be influencing the disease trends that we are seeing around here. So other than the weather station, we are also trapping mosquitoes in this region, and we are monitoring the population of mosquitoes during different times of the year.
Now to Taiwan, where researchers are using a special robot to hunt mosquitoes that carry the virus that causes dengue fever. From the southern city of Kaohsiung, Shelley Schlander has our story.
The World Health Organization says dengue fever is the world's fastest-growing mosquito-borne disease. In Taiwan, health officials here in the city of Kaohsiung are teaming up with local technology firm Geosat to develop this little robot to hunt dengue mosquitoes inside narrow underground rainwater ditches.
We can use the machine to find the hiding breeding source.
The robot is on the lookout for wiggly mosquito larvae like these. Kaohsiung health officials have long urged residents to drain potted plants and tires, anything holding water where mosquitoes can breed. Officials used to not worry about insects breeding in the ditches back when they carried household sewage, which dengue mosquitoes do not like.
Before, the water in these ditches used to be dirtier, more smelly. Since the introduction of the new sewer system, it has become cleaner. But ironically, this is when the problem started to arise.
Dengue-carrying mosquitoes prefer laying their eggs in the cleaner water.
Mosquitoes are like human mothers. They want their children to grow up in their ideal environment.
A mosquito-catching gravitrap shows this street has a high dengue mosquito population, and beneath this rainwater drain there are puddles and larvae.
We can now put the machine in the ditch.
Into the narrow tunnel creeps the robot. When it finds puddles, technicians mark the spot on a ditch database so the health department will know where to blast insecticides to kill mosquito larvae and steam to kill eggs. Kaohsiung Mayor Chen Chi-mai says city health officials are working with Geosat developers on the next generation of dengue fever robot.
New technology application will change the strategy of prevention.
Improvements include enabling the robot to spray insecticides and steam on its own and to use artificial intelligence to identify the mosquitoes that carry the virus that causes dengue fever. They plan to also use robots to release lab-borne mosquitoes containing biological controls that prevent future generations from transmitting dengue fever. Shelley Schlender, VOA News, Kaohsiung, Taiwan.
In Namibia, marijuana trade is illegal and punishment can include a fine and imprisonment. But some who suffer from a medical condition want the government to decriminalize the use of marijuana or cannabis, citing studies that have shown its possible benefits. Vitalio Angula has this report from Schwakopmund, Namibia.
Rainer Kring suffers from a debilitating motor neuron disease, a condition that damages parts of the nervous system, limiting his ability to move around and speak. Kring's condition is a result of a sports injury. Now in his 60s, Kring moves around with the use of a stroller and has speech impairment, making it hard to express himself. Cheryl Green is a Swakopmund-based herbalist who grows various plants in her backyard garden. 4 years ago, she was arrested for dealing in marijuana. She was found guilty of illegally possessing cannabis oil, which she says was used to treat her partner's condition. Green says although she had a very bad experience with her arrest and trial, she continues to advocate for the benefits of medicinal marijuana, calling on the government to change laws that prohibit its use.
Cannabis is phenomenal with all kinds of diseases. Like everything you can think of, I'm trying to think of something, it doesn't heal. I don't think there is anything. It's a fantastic, fantastic herb. And yeah, I'm not happy that I can't grow it and use it. I could have helped thousands of people already.
On the possible decriminalization of medicinal marijuana, the government says it is considering the matter, but has cited the abuse of marijuana and other drugs in the country as a reason why the herb should remain illegal. Although there are people who use marijuana for recreational purposes, others like Kring say they use it to alleviate symptoms of ailments such as motor neuron disease.
I had to stop working, have a repair because of the disability. So, medical purposes, absolutely yes.
Richard Metcalfe, a human rights lawyer, represented Green during her trial. He says Namibia lags behind other progressive African countries, such as South Africa, that have decriminalized the use of cannabis.
No, I just think that it's time that we start needing to keep pace with developments in the rest of the world, and that we utilize products which we're able to grow and grow naturally, and they're not pharmaceutical products, that we utilize them and we utilize the knowledge that Africans specifically have.
Namibia's Prime Minister, Sara Kohongerwa Amadila, who led the task force to investigate the medical benefits associated with marijuana, told VOA that the cabinet considered the request for decriminalizing marijuana on the basis of presumed benefits. However, the cabinet chose not to. Human rights lawyer Metcalfe says the law can only be changed by parliament. Vitalio Angula, VOA News, Swakopmund, Namibia.
You are listening to Health Chat on Voice of America. It's time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Health Chat. Climate change is not just an environmental crisis. It is a nutritional emergency, according to experts. They say rising temperatures, extreme weather events, and shifting precipitation patterns are disrupting agricultural practices, affecting crop yields, and compromising the nutritional value of our food. And Africa is experiencing the devastating impact of climate change at various levels, including nutrition. For more insight, I spoke with Sean Baker, Chief Program Officer at Helen Keller International, a non-profit organization dedicated to helping children and families grow and eat nutritious food and stave off malnutrition, among other things. Take a listen.
You know, the public perception may be that there has been no progress in Africa, and I think it's important to counter that because while, in fact, the challenges in nutrition on the continent are grim, there also has been huge success. So I'm sitting in Senegal where, through government leadership and programming, they brought down the rates of stunting to 17%, which is, in fact, below one of the public health thresholds. That's huge success. We see countries like Rwanda that have almost eliminated the most severe form of malnutrition wasting, and where exclusive breastfeeding rates are the highest in the world, around 87%. Some of our programmatic areas, we work a lot on vitamin A supplementation, which saves lives and prevents blindness. And across 13 countries in Africa, with partnership with government, we're seeing coverage rates twice a year of up 90% of above. And I'm also here sitting in Senegal, and when I go to the supermarket, cooking oil and wheat flour are fortified with essential nutrients. In West Africa, it's been a leader of doing fortifying the food supply with essential nutrients. So it's important, I think, to also start off with the success that has happened in Africa. That being said, unfortunately, Africa is confronted with huge headwinds, which are imperiling all that success. Start with the galloping prices of food, which really make nutritious food out of reach of so many people, and particularly the most vulnerable. There was a recent study that indicated that a 5% increase in food prices translated to a 9% increase of wasting, and that most of that damage is being done to the poorest households. We also are seeing, unfortunately, increasing conflict. I have family in Burkina. I've spent a number of weeks there in the recent months, and it's just devastating of farmers who can't go to the field to grow crops, traders who can't go to the market, sell their food, buy their food, gain their livelihoods, health workers who are targeted, so it empties out health facilities, and then clients don't dare to come, and so access to basic nutrition services. So that's really devastating. And then there is, I think, something we'll talk about more, the ever-growing intensity of climate crises, which really undermine everybody. So there are a lot of headwinds. And so despite the success, there are a lot of challenges. And then specifically, I think, related to urban versus rural, I think there's several things, perhaps three, where the urban environment has specific challenges. One, of course, is that all that social solidarity that exists in rural settings and traditional settings can sometimes break down in urban settings. We see that across the world. So that social, that traditional social safety net breaks down. Secondly, mother's time, which is precious anywhere. In urban settings, mothers are even pulled in. And so their ability to care for children, to nourish their children, is even more constrained. And we're seeing in some of the research we've carried out for quite a while is that there's an increasing invasion of the complementary feeding period by unhealthy ultra-processed foods, which not only do bad in their own right, but they also crowd out nutritious foods. And then I would come back to perhaps the overall what's driving some of this problem. The systems are not always delivering good nutrition services. So we'll have the health systems that might have contacts with mothers and children, but are not delivering nutrition services. So there's progress, there are lots of challenges.
I wanted you to come back to the impact of climate change. How is climate change affecting food security and nutrition on the continent?
There's almost no way it's not affecting food security. I think that in many ways, I see this probably as the most existential threat to nutrition on the continent, because the climate crisis is really undermining every system that families rely on to nourish their children. And every day you come across a new study which will lay out one pathway through which the climate crisis is having impacts on nutrition. There was a recent study that looked at, just as an example, that looked at five countries in West Africa, and it indicates that a 2% Celsius increase of temperature will result in a 7.4 percentage point increase in stunting, suboptimal growth, and that would actually reverse all of the gains in nutrition during the period of the study. That's just one pathway through which the climate crisis is having an impact on nutrition. And I read a lot of the academic literature, but perhaps to me what is most compelling is September a year ago in 2022 at the Pledging to Save Lives event during the United Nations General Assembly, there was a UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador, Vanessa Nakate, who is a climate activist from Uganda, who took the stage, and she had just come back from visiting the Horn of Africa, which has been subjected to recurrent droughts. And she summarized it to me as eloquently as anyone I've ever heard. She said the climate crisis is a nutrition crisis, and that those who are suffering are those who contributed the least to the climate crisis, and there is no climate justice without nutrition justice. And so I think it's so essential that we make very clear to decision makers that one of the deadliest manifestations of the climate crisis is going to be increased malnutrition, which will lead to increased child deaths, and for those children who survive, undermining their futures.
What adaptive strategies should be in place or are already in place to help mitigate the impact of climate change on nutrition?
The climate crisis is an existential threat to the nutrition of mothers and children. We have a whole set of known solutions which can support nutrition of mothers and children. Let's make that link very clear. And so we're looking at funding ways to protect those people most affected by the climate crisis. That scaling up nutrition programs is front and center. So let's act at nutrition at scale. And then also let us make sure that our analysis is very clear about which populations are being the most affected. I think with any crisis, what happens is it just exacerbates pre-existing inequities. And we're seeing that with the climate crisis. It's the people who already suffer poverty, already suffer malnutrition, who are the most at risk. So we need to really prioritize those populations. And then thirdly, one of the most threatening pathways through which the climate crisis is affecting nutrition, of course, is through the food system. Farmers always having to adjust to constantly changing environments. And so we need to make sure that we're supporting particularly smallholder farmers with the technologies they need, the adapted crops they need, and the safety nets they need to be able to continue to produce nutritious food in a climate-challenged world.
What are some of the ways that local communities are being engaged in addressing nutritional issues?
I mean, to me, if local communities are not engaged, then we fail, right? They're at the forefront of suffering the burden of malnutrition, but they're also at the forefront of the solutions. And just some ways off the top of my head that I've seen recently that really move me, I'll come back to the vitamin A supplementation work that we support in a number of countries. In an 18-month period, we have worked and trained 198,000 community health workers. I'm on a campaign to rebrand them as community health heroes who have distributed over that period of time over 100 million vitamin A supplements. In fact, the health system that's the most powerful are community health workers, and they are supported by the communities, they are embedded in the communities, and that's incredibly powerful. Then I'll come back here to Senegal and a program that USAID-funded program, Kawarlor, which we were part of. Really exciting, and I had the opportunity to visit it earlier in the year, where we support women's groups that pre-existed to give them better access to technologies to grow and process nutritious foods. We supported training of leaders so that they would understand the importance of good nutrition and what they could do. And of course, we linked those communities up just not through the community health extension workers, but also the health system, and see really some dramatic results. So a couple of indicators that, you know, nutritionists, we get really excited about. One is minimum acceptable diet for infants and young kids. So that period, 6 to 23 months, when breast milk alone is not enough, those young kids need really nutrient-dense food. At the baseline, fewer than 4% of these infants and young kids were getting a minimum acceptable diet, and that increased sixfold within a 3 or 4 year period to almost 24%. Now, we need to go further, but that just shows by engaging the community how much you can change something like that. Another indicator is exclusive breastfeeding, because during that first 6 months, breast milk is the ideal, and it really, exclusive breastfeeding is an incredibly powerful thing. In that same period of time, by having engaged leadership, culturally informed messaging about breastfeeding, the exclusive breastfeeding rates went from 21% to almost 59%, so almost a threefold increase. So effectively engaging communities is really the secret sauce to make nutrition programs work.
You talked about culturally sensitive approaches. Can you tell us a little more about how cultural norms are being taken into consideration when establishing nutrition programs?
You really put your finger on it, because you know, so much of nutrition is dependent on behaviors and social norms. And I think you can't have well-informed programs if you've not just done the quantitative research, but also that qualitative research. People do things for a reason. And let me go back, for example, to breastfeeding. Throughout particularly hot climates, I live in the Sahel. Of course, as an adult, you're thirsty when it's hot. You think, well, I have to give water to that infant and young child.
That was Sean Baker, Chief Program Officer at Helen Keller International. That's all for this edition of Health Chat. I'm your host, Lenore Moudou in Washington, with producer David Vandy. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and strive to make every day a healthy day.